Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, just glancing at a grassy leaf roof significantly boosts your concentration. University of Melbourne. A study that glancing at green for 40 seconds markedly boosts concentration. That's just the beginning. We have a lot more to go. Also on today's program, we're going to take you into some areas where people are sharing important points of view on public health issues. For example, Dr. Susanna Humphreys, board certified in two areas of medicine, pro-vaccine, ultra-Orthodox in her practice, until she had an opportunity to look at what was happening to some of her own patients who were receiving vaccines for no other reason than that they were in the operating room or in the hospital. And she noticed complications. She began to do the literature research and found to her surprise that these were not indicated. Then why were they being given? 20,000 hours of research later, she's no longer pro-vaccine. You should hear her points of view. So should the other pro-vaccine people. Mind you, I'm not anti-vaccine. I've never said I was. I'm anti-bad science. I'm anti-toxic vaccines. I'm anti-non-effective vaccines. So when someone tells me to take a vaccine because it's safe and effective, I say, fine. Are you guaranteeing me personally, as a physician or pharmacist or a nurse, that if there's any untoward effects, if there's any harm, you will personally pay for it? Well, no. Well, then why should I trust you? Now, if I do the research by just looking at the package insert, will I be surprised? If you're giving me MMR vaccine and the number one side effect is measles, but hold on, why would taking the vaccine give me the measles? And then you start to look at all the other adverse effects, including death and autism. Not my words, the package insert. But then what does the actual peer review independent scientific literature say? And suddenly, you're not an anti-vaxxer. You are a person who is concerned about what goes into your body, and therefore you want to honor your body with freedom of choice. The government should not control my body, nor yours, nor our minds, but it does. And therefore, you have a challenge to them. We'll hear that challenge from Senator Humphrey. Also, if you tell the truth about what's going on, you'll be attacked. Max Blumenthal, the campaign to silence him. And then we have identity politics, and it's very destructive. By people who are ideologues, and they generally have an agenda, a strong ideological agenda, so they don't see anything unique or revealing in someone else's argument. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Explain that more. I'm going to research what you just said. All religions are religions of peace. Really? Interesting thing, one of my close friends for decades, Ibrahim, down in Manhattan, I'm not sure if Ibrahim Malik is still alive or not. He'd be in his 90s. He was very much into health. He used to come by all the time, we'd talk. And so I said, you're the kind of the spiritual leader to all the Muslims in New York area. He said, yeah. He's a PhD from Harvard, very, very bright guy. And I said, what if you went through the Quran? What if you went through all the religious books, the Old Testament, the New Testament, all the other religious books, and you edited out everything that did not honor life, the sanctity of other people, the rights of other people? What would be different about the religion and how it's taught? And he thought for a moment. And that's where we began to have a discussion, and that ended up, you ought to go back and listen to that program. it ended up where I brought on a top Jewish scholar, top Christian scholar from North Carolina University, the head of the department, the dean of the department in Christian studies, and Ibrahim on Islam. And I said, so isn't it more that if you want to find a reason to justify your violence and hatred and bigotry and misogyny, and you can find it. If you want to find something that glorifies your faith and allows you to be a happier person, you can find that also. So it's who interprets it, who has the power, and how convincing they are in convincing other people. And that's a conversation you should listen to. Why can't we approach the subject of how we relate to each other today with an openness to see, wow, is there something you're telling me that I didn't know that I could learn from? So we're going to have a debate today between Professor Jordan Peterson and a leading, highly respected feminist, Helen Lewis. She's a British journalist, deputy editor of the New Statesman. Also, she writes for The Guardian and The Sunday Times. And they both are making important points. Whether we agree or disagree with any given point, it's worth listening to what they have to say. So we have a lot to share. And we always begin with the latest on health and healing. This study published in the Journal of Environmental Psychology gave 150 students a boring, attention-sapping task. The students were asked to press a key on as a series of numbers repeatedly flashed on a computer screen, unless that number was 3. They were given a 40-second break midway through the task to view a city rooftop scene. Half the group viewed a flowering meadow green roof. The other half looked out onto a bare concrete roof. After the break, the students who glanced at the greener vista made significantly less errors and demonstrated superior concentration on the second half of the task compared to those who viewed the concrete roof. The green roof provided a restorative experience that boosted those mental resources that control attention. So when do we give ourselves an opportunity throughout the day to stop and smell the roses? I recently completed a retreat. Interesting, because someone I've known for decades said, I saw some of the positive testimonials. They're simply too good to be true. Even my own brother said, and he's the skeptic of skeptics. He said, Gary, he said, I wouldn't let anyone know that anyone had any positive results. Let them think, okay, they had a nice experience. I said, why is that, Steve? He said, well, you know, you don't want people to start thinking that somehow there's something that can happen when you're doing a particular protocol. I said, so let me get this right, Steve. Like all the people I've had to face that had diminutive ideas, you're now adding one, that I should apologize for being successful in helping people in the road to recovery, that everyone else in the field should do the same. Every physician, psychologist, every therapist, every yoga teacher, every nutritionist, dietitian, holistic nurse, and dentist, everyone in the whole field should say, well, we didn't do that good. It was okay. They didn't die. They made it home with no tapeworms. As if there's only one paradigm and one truth allowed. What does it say about us as a society? What does it say about people who've lived such limited existences on a spiritual level, or non-existent, the atheist? What does it say for those who don't believe what they couldn't themselves do? Well, if I can't do it, nobody can do it. That kind of arrogance, that kind of conceit, that kind of narcissism that borders on sociopathology is what's allowed us not to believe in our own potential as human beings to grow and thrive and survive and share the wonder of life with others. These are regimented, anally retentive individuals, unfortunately, no matter what you say, they can't handle it. Because the only way they handle life is how they've maladapted to their own circumstances, their own egos, and their own limited powers of knowledge. So just imagine that if you were able to help people in their journey, and it was so successful that nobody wanted to know the truth of it. But if you were giving heroic effort using chemotherapy or radiation or psychiatric medications or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, that is praised. Ah, they went to the best doctor. The best doctor, he's so good, he's on the 18th floor of a 14th floor building. He elevates himself up there. He's in levitation mode when he sees you, and he's only $4,000 a minute. It's a deal. It's nothing. We have illusions of the association of power in the orthodoxy, from religion to politics, from education to finance. And we're so wrong. So to my brother, keep doing what you're doing. And please don't try to figure out what I do. You never have, you never will. Or to my friends, I've always said, never ask me what I do because you're not in a place to understand it. But I will tell those of you who still have some sense of wonderment about what we don't know and how what we don't know might open another door in life that allows us to see things differently, more openly, more honestly. Sorry for the anal retentive people coming from some places who just keep showing up and never get it. And I can assure you, one of those people will never be invited again. Because no matter how many times they come, they just don't get it. They live in this very narrow, angry, bitter, rageful, hate-filled, despiteful place. I feel sorry for them. From the University of Basque Country in Spain, breastfeeding protects against environmental pollution. So the more you breastfeed, the healthier baby's going to be, and the least reactive that an environmental sensitive will that baby be. Licorice shows it can kill SARS and other lethal viruses. That's right, European Medicine Agency from Germany. Licorice has a rich and ancient history of use as a medicine, being rooted in India, China, Greece, Egyptian traditions. Technically, it's a legume related to beans and peas. Its sweetness results from the presence of glycyrrhizin, a compound 50 times sweeter than sugar. And this compound is what gave licorice its name, which derives from the Greek word of glucorikesa, meaning sweet, which is glucu, the root, risa, but its properties don't end with its sweetness. It's also one of the most powerful antiviral compounds ever studied. A study on its inhibitory activity against SARS and the coronavirus was published in The Lancet. No one seemed to pay attention to it. Well, I pay a lot of attention to anything that helps with viruses because I work with so many people who have HIV and cytomegalovirus and chronic fatigue syndrome. So if there's another way of helping the body destroy viruses, I want to know about it. So I read that article, and now we have all these people dying by the tens of thousands in hospitals from the SARS infection. And here we have it. It can kill the SARS. That's important. Now, you should get it in an amount that is safe to use, and preferably you should use it if you have viruses or infections under the trained supervision of probably the best person would be a naturopath, board-certified naturopath. Also, the Swinburne University of Technology found that plant extracts offer hope against diabetes and cancer. And what they did was rather unique. They showed that traditional Aboriginal and Indian plant extracts could be used to manage the diseases, and including treatment for cancer. And this is a very respected university of technology. They had all these PhDs, and they looked at 7 Australian Aboriginal medicine plants and 5 Indian Ayurvedic plants to determine their anti-diabetic potential, and they all worked. Now, I'm simply posting this article today, not because you can run out and get Witchetty Bush, you can't, or to get the Australian sandalwood, that you could get. Some of these are available, but you'd have to go to a trained herbalist to get them, or an Ayurvedic doctor. The point of this exercise is to show you that in spite of all the attacks by Wikipedia and its skeptics, know-nothings, by diminishing even your desire to look at Oriental or Ayurvedic medicines as if there's no science, there's an enormous amount of science published in the peer-reviewed literature supporting their efficacy and safety. Now, they're not reading this study. They're not looking at these 12 medicinal plant extracts to show that they actually increase glucose uptake and adipogenesis, which is the formation of fatty tissue, therefore helping you reduce fat. And also, 2 of these extracts had strong anti-cancer activity. They don't want to know about it, because to know about it would be to then cast doubt on the certainty of their own skepticism. You see, the one thing you'll never be disappointed in with a skeptic, or an orthodox doctor, or an orthodox scientist, is that they'll never allow anything into their consciousness that could challenge their own self-righteousness, because their egos are so infantile. About that of it. When I look at a group of scientists, I'm looking at a group of terrible 2s running amok. This was published in the British Medical Journal, Competent in Alternative Medicine. And by the way, from Istanbul University, blueberries, remember I was talking about those yesterday, how good they are for the brain? They're using it to treat decreased D-galactose-induced oxidative stress and brain damage. So, it means if you have any brain damage, any, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, you should be using blueberries. They suggest a pint a day. I suggest 16 ounces of the blueberry juice. That would be about probably 2 to 3 pounds of blueberry a day. Again, if you're going to do something, do it at a level that's going to have a functional value. And from Qingdao University in China comes a new study that fruits and vegetables help prevent lung cancer. That's good. This was a meta-analysis. Multiple studies were reviewed and found that the more fruits and vegetables you're consuming, the less cancer you're going to have. And from the University of Texas at Galveston, drinking chamomile tea decreases the risk of death in older Mexican-American women. This was published in the Journal of the Gerontologist. So, drink chamomile. By the way, chamomile is one of the oldest, most widely used, and well-documented medicinal plants in the world. It has multiple healing benefits. But this study examined a 7-year period of 1,677 women and men from the Hispanic establishment population for epidemiological study of the elderly. And they found that those who drank the chamomile tea every day had a 29% decreased risk of death from all causes among women compared to non-users. So, for all the women of Mexico and men, drink your chamomile tea every day. And finally, why getting by on little or no sleep spells trouble for cells and organs. This is from the Medical College of Wisconsin, and what it's really saying is that many people are aware that they should try their best to get up in the morning and go to bed at a reasonable time at night to get a good night's sleep, 7 to 8 hours. But a lack of that then makes you groggy the following day, and it makes you more responsible for dying, 1,550 fatalities from people being drowsy and falling asleep when they drove. And 40,000 had injuries in cars because they fell asleep and didn't die. And sleep deprivation is linked to cells and organ damage. You literally can damage the organs and prematurely age your body by not getting sleep. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Sleep. And if you want to reduce the risk of a cough or cold, from the University of Auckland, which is in New Zealand, green tea and grapes. You could reduce by 33% against getting a cold and or upper respiratory tract infections if you ate flavonoids or took flavonoid supplements. So I'm thinking apples, blueberries, cacao, onions. Sweet onion a day keeps your lungs open and kills viruses. It's great and thins your blood and prevents strokes. And it's great for your skin and collagen. Or you can take supplements and do that. And from Umeå University in Sweden, Parkinson's disease is more likely in people with depression. This was published in the journal Neurology. So here's the takeaway. If you continue staying within a depressed state of mind, one of the doors you're going to open will probably be Parkinson's, if you live that long. So what we need is not another antidepressive medication or another selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Effexor. We don't need any of that. We shouldn't have that. What we need is more humanistic counseling that gets to the issues in our life that are causing us to feel helpless, hopeless, or disempowered, where then our state becomes one of depression. I'll do one more from Tel Aviv, Saraski Medical Center in Israel. If you want to keep Alzheimer's at bay, run for your life and exercise. That's right. I mentioned a separate study this week, but exercise slows down the aging of the brain and can reduce risks of Alzheimer's. That's the takeaway message. We're going to take, and by the way, orange juice is good for your aging brain. Make it fresh. University of Reading in the United Kingdom. Drinking a glass of orange juice every day improves brain function. That's very important. That's it on health and nutrition. We are, we're almost 30 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come back with your questions. Please stay with us.
Yes, my name is Mark Rosen. I'm interested in finding out about CBD oil and its effectiveness with people with anxiety.
Okay. It's quite simply one of the most important, non-toxic, non-addictive, it doesn't give you the hallucination effect of marijuana, but it has got multiple studies that can help you. For example, when I was doing an article on the medicinal value of cannabis, I came across over 22,000 scientific references to the cannabis health benefits on the PubMed, the government's official publication for peer review quality studies. If you just went to Harvard University's website, you're going to find dozens of studies. Chronic pain control, especially beneficial for pain if you have multiple sclerosis. Far safer than any opiates. You can't overdose on it. It's better than non-steroidal anti-inflammatories such as Advil and Aleve that I don't recommend anyone use. You can use it if you have GERD and ulcers or problems with kidneys. It's a fantastic muscle relaxant. It lessens tremors from neurological conditions like Parkinson's. It helps treat seizures, epilepsy, Dravet syndrome, is successful at treating fibromyalgia, endometriosis, interstitial cystitis, which is a bladder infection. It's good for the management of nausea and weight loss. It helps to treat glaucoma. It's shown to be particularly beneficial for African Americans with glaucoma rates being very high. And there's a very large body of research now showing its use for veterans who are traumatized with post-traumatic stress disorder. I would suggest every one of the vets from Vietnam to Afghanistan and Iraq and right up till today, don't take the meds before you get your humanistic psychologist, not the pill pushers of Big Pharma, to get you on the cannabinoids. It's good for irritable bowel, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's. It's good for cancer, especially lung cancer and brain cancers. In fact, look up these journals. These are all mainstream, highly respected journals. The Cancer Metastasis Review, the Annals of Internal Medicine, Oncogene, the Journal of Immunology. They all show that cannabinoids have stability to turn off certain cancer genes and prevent cancer cells from making copies of themselves. So why isn't it used? Well, because it's not going to cost you very much money, and the oncologist isn't going to make money, the hospital's not going to make money, and after all, number one is making money. You take the profit out of medicine, we have universal health care with a refund to the American public. Not a penny would have to be expended beyond what, let's say, $1.7 trillion versus $3.5 trillion, and we get nothing except pain, death, destruction from that. That would be what happened if you took the profit out of medicine. And one of the things you could be replacing a lot of those medicines with is the CBDs. All right, Alzheimer's, THC, this psychoactive molecule, slows development of amyloid buildup. Treating insomnia without the nightmare associated with drugs. Autoimmune conditions, because CBD's anti-inflammatory properties, notably, I would use it in arthritis and lupus. And if you have bowel disease, CBD has been shown to prevent entry of pathogenic bacteria. Hope that helps you. We'll take one other call.
Hi, my name is Domenica, and I have a question regarding a child with addiction and what I can possibly give her to help her with the detoxing, because she's suffering very much. I already lost one daughter 3 years ago, so now I'm losing another one. So my brother is very into your products, and I need some advice in what to buy, what to give her.
I can't give you any information with that little bit of information. I don't know how old your child is, whether it's a male or female. Is it a teenager? You know, you could be 45 years old and have a 22-year-old who's strung out on methamphetamine. You could have a baby that was just born that if you were addicted, it's going to more often than not be addicted. You see, you've given me no information from which I can make a reasonable suggestion and protocol. I would suggest that you redo this, but give very much the details I need. It'd be like someone calling and says, Gary, I got headaches. What do you got for them? What kind of headaches? How often? When do they occur? I need details. So give me the details. I'll be happy to give you a protocol. Okay? I've helped a lot of people overcome addictions. I was head of the addiction unit at Trafalgar Hospital for a long time. So it's not the information doesn't exist. You can't just make a general statement that has any meaning. We're going to go to a couple of e-clips now. And the first one is going to be Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, of why she left her job, a very secure, well-paying job, where she was highly respected. Mind you, she was ultra-orthodox pro-vaccine until she did her homework. This is not a long clip, but it's a very revealing one.
You know, a lot of your story starts around 2009, or a big portion of it, with H1N1. I remember it. I had kids, young kids at that age. There was long lines. There were shortages. And everybody scrambled to go, to go get that shot. What struck you as a traditionally trained doctor about that whole scene and scenario?
Well, the funny thing is initially nothing struck me about it, because I didn't take flu shots for myself, because when I was in medical school, I was coerced into taking one when I did my emergency room rotation. And I got so sick after that flu shot. And everyone told me that it wasn't related and it was a coincidence and I was crazy. But still, intuitively, I just thought, I do fine every winter. I'm not going to do this. And so I just didn't pay any attention to it. But I knew that all my dialysis patients were getting first dibs at this vaccine. I knew one of my medical partners was really upset because he couldn't get it. So he went over to another hospital to get his, and I just thought, well, you can have mine if you want it. So nothing really struck me about it until that first patient said what he said to me, which was, I was fine until I had that vaccine. And he was on dialysis at that day. And he said it to me as if he had said it to 10 people before and nobody listened to him. It was like he told the story so many times. And I said, what vaccine? And he said, that flu shot. And so I went into his record from his outpatient visit, and I saw that he had the regular seasonal influenza vaccine as well as the H1N1, because that year they were giving two injections. And I suspect that may be why, you know, there was kind of a blip in what I was seeing that year, because there was pretty much double the dose of the vaccine that year. And the older population was getting a much higher dose of antigen in the vaccine as well. So that was kind of around the time when seniors started getting, a ramped up vaccine. So, or it just could be because I was totally asleep and just never noticed this stuff before and nobody brought it to my attention. But this was the first time anyone said to me, I was fine until I had that vaccine. And because, you know, as a nephrologist, you want to get to the bottom of what caused your patient's kidney failure, because there's always the possibility that if you find it, there's something reversible. So I investigated, and everyone kept telling me that it couldn't be the flu shot. And I thought, wait a minute, how come if it was an aminoglycoside antibiotic or a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent or a statin drug, and I said it's from that, everybody would just nod and they would discontinue the drug and that would be the end of it. But because I suggested that this guy might know what happened to him and that we should look into it, the wall of resistance I was met with is really what alerted me that there's something weird going on. And then a second patient came through not that long after, same story. And then I thought, okay, I have to start to look closely at this, even on my inpatients. So when people were admitted and I was consulted, I would see where the kidney function, we measure by measuring something called creatinine. And so I would see that level, and then I would see anything that happened in between when it was normal to when it rose. And I would look to see if any vaccines were given, which I'd never done before. I'd never done that, to look to see if it's not even part of the history, is when was your latest vaccine. Sure. And it really should be part of every medical history, is when was your last vaccine, because vaccines are drugs and they're multi-compound drugs with multiple effects in the body. But, you know, as medical doctors, we're basically given the vaccine schedule and we're so overwhelmed. So some people think, well, you're smart, you're educated, you're a medical doctor. Why wouldn't you just think to look on your own? And it's like, well, because I thought like everyone else did. The World Health Organization knew what they were doing. I was given a good education in medical school. It's already been done by other people who are way smarter than me. And this is the vaccine schedule and the vaccines have to be given on time. And so I just ran with that. And so all of my dialysis patients were vaccinated unless they chose not to be on their own. So around this time, I started looking at the vaccines that were given. I started making that part of my own medical history because I became suspicious. And there was one other case, which is worth mentioning, which it was another change that happened around 2009, which was that I admitted a patient of my own to the hospital who had an inflammatory kidney problem. And normally I would go up to the ward and I would do my own admission orders and then deal with whatever I had to deal with. And I had to do a kidney biopsy on her. And that was the reason I admitted her. Well, when I got there, because I was in clinic all day and I finally got up to see her, I saw that there was an order in the chart for a flu shot and it had been given. And the ordering physician was me. And I thought, wait, this must be a mistake because I haven't been here yet today. And I wouldn't just order a vaccine. And the nurse said to me, no, this is the new policy, which is that the pharmacist goes in and offers the patient the vaccine. If they agree, then I give the shot. And so I just hit the roof at that point. I thought, this is a patient with an inflammatory disease to start with, kidney dysfunction, and you're going and putting a biological into her that I didn't approve of. Well, I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with her. So at that point, I did more research to prove to the administration that this absolutely, like, that for me was where everything stopped and I stopped being flexible. I said, this is not okay that we're trying to figure out what's wrong with somebody and you're injecting inflammatory substances into them. It's not only a detriment to the patient, it's a detriment to me as a physician. I can't figure out what's happening here. You're confusing the picture. Why can't we just give the vaccine on the discharge day? Why do you have to do it before I've even made an assessment? And so they said, well, vaccines are safe and vaccines are effective and they need to be given on time and they're not going to hurt your patient. And I said, but I'm the medical doctor. I admitted the patient, don't I get to decide what goes into my patient when they're under my care? And they said, well, here's what we'll do is we'll take your name off the order in the future and it will be the administration. We'll take the responsibility. And I said, no, that's still not okay. So then I really dug into my research at that point. And so the first shot, even though I was met with, what about polio and what about smallpox? Mm-hmm. I started to investigate first the flu shot. And that's when I found cases from all over the world of all kinds of, precipitation of kidney problems in normal people after being given vaccines. And this was a whole new book that was opened up to me that I'd never considered before. So I wrote a 13-page paper that had about 56 medical references in it, submitted it to the hospital administration, and was met with dead silence, nothing. I sent it to about 7 people in the high up levels of nursing and medical administration. And so after this dead silence of about a month and a half, I got a letter from some, quality assurance medical doctor from New Hampshire, who they must have kind of hired out to respond to me, who gave me an absolutely absurd response about, that we just have to do it because it's part of the new program and that my medical references were from the past 20 years and that they were from all over the world. And so that means that there are not enough of them that I can just cite them, 101 year from the United States. And so the proof that vaccines were safe in people who have medical problems was a list of medical references that he dug up showing that people with AIDS will make antibody after the given flu shots. That was it. And so at that point, I realized, this is not a battle that's even worth fighting for me anymore. Like, I could have stayed in the hospital for years and fought back, but I probably would have been fired at some point. And so I just decided I was just going to continue my research. It was so fascinating to me, and it just felt like something that I was born to do at that point. And so I just kept researching, kept finding, like, once you start digging up the polio history.
So as you see, when she looked for the truth, there was no truth there. And I'll bet that 99% of all scientists and physicians who do the work that she and Dr. Tony Bark and others have done, they will have a different perception of the safety and efficacy of vaccines as well as the trustworthiness of what comes out of the CDC. Now we're going to play a debate. The debate is between Professor Jordan Peterson and feminist Helen Lewis. They both are credible people. They both make very important arguments. Listen to see whether or not anything either says is of relevance to you or gives you a different perspective. Because afterwards, I'd like to leave a few minutes for you to call in and share your perspective at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. You'll have an opportunity to give talk back to these two people jousting it out.
How much responsibility do you feel you have, particularly guys at the alt-right, who, as you say, some of them have enjoyed your work and say,
no,
I'm not one of you guys. I'm not with you guys.
They haven't enjoyed my work.
I've definitely read bits on the internet.
Read more.
You've sold 2 million copies of 12 Rules for Life. You have 800,000 followers on Twitter, 1.4 million followers on YouTube. What is it that you're selling that so many people want to buy?
I don't think I'm selling anything.
Well, I went to a show where you were selling tickets to your show, so people are willing to pay a lot of money to see you speak. What is it that you think that people are hungry for? They want to hear from you.
They're hungry for a discussion of the relationship between responsibility and meaning. And we haven't had that discussion in our culture for 50 years. We've concentrated on rights and privileges and freedom and impulsive pleasure, and those are all useful in their place, but they're shallow, and that's not good, because if people are moored shallowly, then storms wreck them, and storms come along. So I'm talking to people about how they can build a foundation underneath them that works, and people need to know that, because otherwise their lives are harder than they need to be.
Well, what is it that you have that no one else has? What are you offering that no one else is right now?
Well, I think that is what I'm offering. That's not part of the public discussion, you know, and it's grounded in my clinical knowledge. So I've been a clinician for a very long time, and I'm familiar with the works of most of the great 20th century clinicians, and a reasonable amount of philosophy and a good swath of literature, and I'm a credible scientist, and so I can bring that all together. And I've tried to bring it all together and to make a case for the significance of individual life and the psychological necessity of courage and nobility and responsibility, these things that sound old-fashioned, but are old-fashioned in the best sense. They're old-fashioned because they've lasted forever and they're absolutely necessary. And people need a call to responsibility because they need to mature. They need to want to be adults. You know? And I don't think we do a very good job in our culture of making a case for why it's a good thing to be an adult.
And two things really made you famous, which is, first of all, is the book, 12 Rules for Life. Mm-hmm. The second one, I think, was an interview that went viral with Kathy Newman of Channel 4 News, which mm-hmm. she talked about
Joe
men
Rogan's
and women.
Joe Rogan's podcasts help plenty.
Too. Right, he's got a big, big following. But that was, I think, really fascinating, that interview, because it was specifically mm-hmm. about men and women. And you said at the time, you know, YouTube skews very male and your fan base is very male. Mm-hmm. Is that still the case? Are you still mostly primarily talking to men?
I would say the talks are probably 60-40, 65-35 male to female. The book sales, I don't know. I doubt it, because usually it's women who buy books, although men do buy nonfiction if they buy books. We don't know the demographics on the books. But the book has definitely expanded my audience, I would say. And that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I never set out specifically to talk to men. My students for most years at the university have been primarily female. I think most of my graduate students have been female. It might be about 50-50, but I think it would probably tilt more in the direction of female. So it wasn't something I set out to do. I think, though, that, as I said earlier, well, I can't tell how much of it is merely a consequence of the fact that YouTube skews so male. It might also be something to do with the call to take on voluntary responsibility. I'm not exactly sure why that would be more necessary for men right now. I think it might be because our culture confuses men's desire for achievement and competence with the patriarchal desire for tyrannical power. And that's a big mistake. Those aren't the same thing, even a bit. So, and it's very inappropriate psychologically and sociologically to confuse them. So.
Well, one of the things I want to come back to is this idea. So that you say in the book, you know, there is masculine order and feminine chaos.
Mm. I say that those are symbolic representations of the two things.
Right, okay. Mm. So why? Why is order masculine?
I think it's because our primary social hierarchy structures are fundamentally masculine.
And that's not the patriarchy?
Well, it's not the modern idea of the patriarchy, that's for sure.
I mean, that's my idea of the patriarchy, which is a system of male dominance of society.
Yeah, but that's not my sense of the patriarchy.
So what's yours?
Well, in what sense is our society male-dominated?
The fact that the vast majority of wealth is owned by men, the vast majority of capital is owned by men. Women do more unpaid labour.
It's a very, very tiny proportion of men, and a huge proportion of people who are seriously disaffected are men. Most people in prison are men. Most people who are on the street are men. Most victims of violent crime are men. Most people who commit suicide are men. Most people who die in wars are men. People who do worse in school are men. It's like, where's the dominance here precisely? What you're doing is you're taking a tiny substrata of hyper-successful men and using that to represent the entire structure of Western society. There's nothing about that that's vaguely appropriate.
But I could say equally well that most rape victims are women. You know, terrible things happen to people of both sexes.
And you could say that with perfect utility, but that doesn't provide any evidence for the existence of a male-dominated patriarchy.
Well, there
it
are,
just means that terrible things happen to both genders, which they certainly do.
But there are almost no women who rape men, for example. So that is an asymmetry there in sexual violence.
Well, yes, there's an asymmetry in all sorts of places, but that doesn't mean that Western culture is a male-dominated patriarchy. The fact that there are asymmetries has nothing to do with your basic argument.
No, but you might
this is a trope that people just accept. Western society is a male-dominated patriarchy. It's like, no, it's not. That's not true. And even if it has a patriarchal structure to some degree, the fundamental basis of that structure is not power. It's competence. That's why our society works. It's only when a structure degenerates into tyranny that the fundamental relationships between people become dependent on power. It's not power. If you hire a plumber who's likely to be male, it's not because there's roving bands of tyrannical plumbers forcing you to make that choice. And it's the case with almost every interaction that you have at the face of our culture. You're dealing with people who are offering a service of one form or another, who are usually part of the broad middle class, and who offer, and what you're looking for is the person who can offer the best service, and you can find it. It's not a consequence of being dominated by anything that's tyrannical. And then again, our culture, our Western culture, which is by no means perfect, and certainly has tyrannical elements, like all cultures do, is the least tyrannical society that's ever been produced, and certainly the least tyrannical society that exists now. So where's the patriarchy exactly in all of this?
Well, saying that it's the least tyrannical society is not the same as saying it's not a tyrannical society.
That's exactly why I said it was the least tyrannical society.
But that's what I mean. So you haven't debunked the existence of patriarchy then. You've said that actually now is better for women.
I don't have to debunk it.
Women.
You have to demonstrate its existence.
Okay, well, let's go through it. I'm writing a book about feminism in the moment. Until 1919, there were professions that women were barred from. They simply were not allowed to do it. Until 1880s...
Why would you blame men for that?
Because who was in those professions, who was guarding entry to those professions, who was worried about losing their status if women became doctors?
What do you think it was that emancipated women in the 20th century, just out of curiosity?
Well, a couple of different things. I think it was technology. I think it was the pill helped enormously because it gave people...
When was that developed?
When in the 60s.
Right, so that wasn't 1919.
No, but I also think it was a series of legal changes that started in Britain with the Married Women's Property Act, which said for the first time women are full legal beings under the law. They can own property. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is a structure that has continued throughout from a time when women didn't have the same legal rights as men to now when they mostly do, mm-hmm. but culture still lags behind it. I don't think you and I are necessarily talking at such cross purposes. It's just that your conception of patriarchy, as I see it in the book, is that quite a lot of men are quite nice and they do nice things for women. And
no, that's not my conception of patriarchy. And I don't require men or advise them to be nice, ever.
Well, you do talk about the guy who's the tampon king, the sanitary towel king of India, right?
And I wouldn't call that nice.
Okay,
I'd call that brave.
Okay.
Did you read about his life when he was trying to develop that?
Yeah.
God, it was absolutely miserable, and he did it anyways. He right. freed all sorts of women as a consequence.
And I think
that's
that
was... nice. That's courageous. That's noble. That's visionary. It's not nice.
I think it is also nice. I think it is also something that is, honouring your social obligations.
I'm not so sure that that's a social obligation, because many other people would have done it had it been a social obligation. He said what he was concerned about. He saw that his wife was suffering with her monthly period and had to choose between feeding her family and taking care of herself properly, and chose to feed her family and thought he would do something about that. That goes way past nice, especially given what he had to suffer through to do all the experimentation that produced his eventual technology. So, this whole patriarchy thing, I think you have no idea how pernicious and dangerous it is.
Well, no, I don't. I really don't.
Throughout history, have fundamentally cooperated to push back against the absolute catastrophe of existence, a terrible death rate, the probability of chronic starvation, early death, disease, the difficulty of raising children, with all the death that was associated with that, and to look backwards in time and say, well, basically what happened was men took the upper hand and persecuted women in this tyrannical patriarchy. Is it's absolutely dreadful misreading of history. It's a terrible thing to teach young women, and it's a horrible thing to inflict upon men.
I mean, I absolutely disagree with you. I think that's like saying slavery in the US was actually, most people cooperate. Well, no, you didn't. You had a system where one set of people owned another set of people. And until women got full legal rights, they could own property for themselves, they could work. Essentially, they were owned. They were
first owned by their fathers and then by their husbands. To the domination by men.
Yeah.
You already said that you thought that what emancipated women primarily in the 20th century was technological revolution.
No, not primarily, but that's one of two. I think that's two things.
It's not primarily, eh?
No.
You don't think the pill was a primary force in the emancipation of women?
I think
or the invention of tampons, let's say, or the provision of proper sanitary facilities, toilets, and that sort of thing. You're thinking instead it was the action of courageous feminists in the 1920s that produced a social revolution that overthrew the patriarchy. That's your theory.
Yeah,
I think... That's a foolish theory.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear you say that, but I think, to quote you in the Kathy Newman interview, I think it's a multivariate, right? I think there are lots of different things that all contributed to women getting
equal
rights.
Well, then let's not be assuming that Western society was a tyrannical patriarchy.
Well, no, but that's one of them, and then other things happened as well. So you have the pill, you have the dishwasher and white goods, labour-saving devices in the home. I think all of those were really important. But you also have things like campaigns for the vote.
Yes, you also have things like that, yes.
So how, when in a system that existed in England until 1918, when...
Why would you even want to look at history like that? Like, what's your goal?
Because exactly. I think the people who don't look at history are condemned to repeat it, and I think that we are...
What are we going to do? Repeat the persecution of women? Do you think that's a realistic possibility?
Yeah, we're sitting here...
How do you see that?
We're sitting here in America, right, where we've just had a fifth judge appointed to the Supreme Court who is now anti-abortion, is now conservative. I think that abortion rights are accidentally fundamental to women being able to function as full humans in society, and I think that is now under threat in America. I think it is extremely smug and complacent to think civilization has peaked, it's all upwards from here.
Yeah, well... Good luck with that, I suppose.
It's a living. There are lots of people who agree with me. There are lots of people clearly who agree with you.
There are just a lot of people, I would say, who are coming to listen to what I say because they're sick and tired of having their desire to move forward in the world and to achieve something and to take their place as adult males, let's say, who are under the weight of accusations that they're ambition and forthrightness is a manifestation of something that's fundamentally tyrannical. They're not happy with that. It's not doing anyone any good, and it's also not true. It's really a terrible thing to do to young men, and it's happening all the time. That's why they're bailing out of universities like mad. There won't be a man left in the social sciences in 10 years in the universities, and it's no bloody wonder. It's an unhospitable place, and it's unhospitable precisely because of this doctrine. So that throughout history, the fundamental relationship between men and women was one of power, essentially slavery. It's like, fine, believe it if you want. It's not going to do your relationships any good, I can tell you that. So.
Okay, well, we'll see how that one goes. I'm currently married, but I'll raise it with him. I think the university's example is a really fascinating one, because you talk in the book about the fact that now women are a majority on 2/3 of college courses in the US. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've also seen you saying, well, you believe in equality of opportunity, but not equality of outcome. Maybe women...
It isn't only that I don't believe in equality of outcome. I think it's an unbelievably pathological wish and doctrine.
Right,
and
it's very
dangerous. History has demonstrated exactly how dangerous it is. Equality of opportunity is something that anyone with any sense would support. But equality of outcome, it's...
So what's your problem with there not being...
You beyond belief to support equality of outcome.
Okay, so what's your problem with there not being enough men in the social sciences? Perhaps women are just cleverer. Perhaps that's why there are more women at university, right? Under your doctrine. I don't think that, but that's
the
logical extension of your doctrine.
It isn't the fact that there's an unequal distribution. The problem I have with it is that the reason that men are bailing out is because of the prevalence of the doctrine that you're espousing. That's the problem I have with it. It doesn't matter that much. They will bail out. I don't see any way that the universities are going to redeem themselves in the next decade. So, and maybe that will be fine. But I doubt it. We'll see.
That seems extremely pessimistic when the numbers of people going to university just generally are going up.
Yeah, well, that's not going to last for very long.
Why not?
Because it's too expensive and the universities are doing all sorts of things that aren't acceptable. Mostly ratcheting up the price. So, and decreasing the quality of what they're offering and playing into the hands of the people who are ideological acolytes of the identity politics routines and playing postmodern stunts and pushing neo-Marxism and all these things that are characteristic of the social sciences and the humanities primarily.
See, this is where I find you fascinating to me because, you know, you talk in these quite apocalyptic terms. I think that, you know, someone will listen to that and think, wow, there's a really big problem. But what we're really talking about is some irritatingly postmodern professors and some students with blue hair and funny ideas about gender in a handful of courses around America and Western Europe.
We will have another segment of this discussion, this debate, and we don't have any time left to take any calls, but on our next program, I'd like for you to just make a note of what you learned that you didn't know, what you would agree or disagree with from each of the people so that you can give us your interpretations and impressions. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I'll be here on Monday live to do a program. Look forward to sharing with you at that time. Have a nice weekend, everyone.